Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Hi, it's Martha Stewart. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about dirt. At 3 a.m., at all hours of the day, really. What people don't know is that not all dirt is the same. You need dirt with the right kind of nutrients. New Miracle-Gro organic raised bed and garden soil is so dense, so full of nutrient-rich, high-quality ingredients. Miracle-Gro is simply the best.
Welcome to True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you are doing, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and with me, as always, is a man that says music is the food of love. He is the captain.
Well, you can just call me Sexual Chocolate. It's good to be seen, and it's good to see you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for telling a friend.
This week we are sipping on Double Cross by Crux Fermentation Project, garage grade 4 out of 5 bottle caps. This is a Belgian strong dark ale, big bodied with intense flavors of dark candy sugar, preserved fruit, and holiday spices. And this week's beer, Double Cross, was brought to us by Marina in the UK, who says, we should run for president.
Well, maybe your mom should run for president. A big shout out to Tammy from Portland, Oregon.
And a shout out to Grizz, who says he lives in the state of love and trust out in BFE, Illinois.
And a big long distance, we like your jib, to Christian in Hong Kong.
And we have another Tammy captain who is listening from beautiful south of North Carolina. And last but not least, we have Sylvia, who says True Crime Garage gets 5 out of 5 bottle caps.
Yes.
So thank you to everybody for helping out with this week's show. Go to truecrimegarage.com. Check out the blog. Check out the store. Check it out.
Yeah, and go to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review. It helps us in the rankings and all that crap. So also, you can check us out on Stitcher. If you're looking for old episodes, go to Stitcher. They're all free, exclusively on the Stitcher app. And that's enough of the business.
All right, everybody, gather around, grab a chair, grab a beer. Let's talk some true crime. In February of 1980, all hell, and I do mean hell, broke loose. At 1 a.m. on February 2nd, inmates at a maximum security prison just south of Santa Fe jumped 3 prison guards during a routine dorm count. By 2:05 a.m., the inmates had complete control of the prison. 2 prison gangs, the Chicanos and the Aryan Brotherhood, they had their own agendas. After the takeover, the call was to immediately seek revenge against the snitches housed in cell block 4. As dawn broke, a group of inmates later nicknamed the Execution Squad broke into cell block 4. The rioters could not open the cell doors. However, They managed to find blowtorches that were used to renovate the overcrowded prison in Block 5. Unfortunately, they were able to use the blowtorches to open each cell in Block 4, one at a time. When opened, the victims were pulled from their cells to be tortured, dismembered, hanged, or burned alive. Inmates killed inmates with piping, work tools, and homemade shanks. Some of the inmates in this time of chaos and crisis showed they were of good character. Some of the correction officers held captive were protected by inmates. At inmates' instruction, two officers removed their uniforms and put on prison clothes to disguise themselves and avoid being attacked. These two officers were later escorted out of the prison, protected by inmates. However, other inmates showed their true colors given the opportunity and reminded us all why they were locked up in the first place, as two very unfortunate officers were so brutally beaten and raped that they had to be carried out of the prison on stretchers. Seven officers were severely injured. The riot only lasted about 36 hours, but in the end, the official death toll was 33 people. All of them inmates. 12 of the victims had been housed in the protective custody unit. Most of the 33 were brutally murdered. Some died from a drug overdose. More than 200 inmates were treated for injuries. Later, there would be several books about this prison riot and its causes and aftermath. And to give you a better idea of the total carnage, one book is titled The Hate Factory and the other, The Devil's Butcher Shop. The 1980 New Mexico State Penitentiary riot was the most violent prison riot in American history. Then, state official Michael Franke was brought in to completely revamp the troubled and broken New Mexico prison system. Franke investigated and exposed the corruption that was leading to severe problems and was officially recognized for his achievements by political leaders such as former U.S. President Jimmy Carter. He served as a judge for 3 years and in 1983 became the director of the New Mexico Department of Corrections. In May of 1987, Oregon Governor Neil Goldschmidt hired Michael Franke to fill the corresponding position in Oregon. Franke was hired to address problems in the Oregon State's Department of Corrections. After coming to Oregon, Franke learned many unfavorable things about what was happening behind prison walls. The corruption was rampant and included murder, prostitution, drugs, and even stealing cattle. As it turns out, prison guards in the 80s were taking inmate crews out and stealing cattle from local farms and ranches, and then making money by supplying steaks to local restaurants. It was exposed during the 1980s that officials at the Oregon Department of Corrections were enlisting the help of convicted murderers inside the prison and rewarding them by providing them weekend passes. At least one of these weekend passes for a convicted murderer led to another murder. Simply put, Michael Franke was hired to clean up a giant mess. Franke told his family he was going to blow the lid off of corruption in the Oregon prison system and implicate several top government officials. However, that did not happen because he was murdered before he could do so. Michael Franke was a good man, an ethical man that stood up for what was right and fought corruption and the corrupted. This is his story. Michael Franke was a native of Kansas City, Missouri. He was born October 2nd, 1946, and after graduating high school, he attended New Mexico's Highland University on a football scholarship. He would graduate with a Bachelor of Arts degree and a combined major of political science, economics, German, and French. Then he attended the University of Virginia Law School, and he graduated with a law degree in 1971 and was subsequently admitted to the Virginia Bar. For the next 3 years, he served as a judge advocate general in the United States Navy at Long Beach Naval Station. Now, in 1975, he was admitted to the bar in New Mexico and worked as an assistant attorney general and counsel to the State Department of Corrections. He served in this capacity until 1980, when he became a judge for the First District Court in Santa Fe. He served as a judge for 3 years, and then in 1983 became the director of the New Mexico Department of Corrections. And we heard in the trailer there, Captain, what state they were in as far as the Department of Correction goes for New Mexico State. The problems there were bad. That riot that we described probably and most likely was caused by severe overcrowding within the prison system. That particular prison had almost double the amount of inmates that it was built to house, some of them sleeping without beds. And then we also have brutality from both sides of the cell block door, from the inmates and from some of the correction officers as well. In May of 1987, Oregon Governor Neil Goldschmidt hired Michael Franke to fill the corresponding position in Oregon. Franke was hired to address problems in the Oregon State's Department of Corrections. The main purpose, however, for his hiring was to oversee the largest prison expansion in Oregon State history. It was necessary to expand due to severe overcrowding in these prisons as well. Now, we already spoke of the checkered history of the Oregon prison system, and Michael Franke was the man tasked with removing the corruption of the Oregon State Department of Corrections. But he took heavy criticism when he first came in by legislatures for the cost of overruns and delays in the state's prison construction program. These same legislators were also growing increasingly frustrated about the rising inmate population. So the Oregon system was experiencing severe overcrowding, with up to 5,000 inmates crammed into prisons originally designed for 2,800 people. Still, it's believed by many that he figured out who was doing what and was ready to report it to his superiors. Franke told his family that he was going to blow the lid off of corruption in the Oregon prison system and implicate several top government officials. Now, this leads us to January 17th, 1989. So we know a little bit about Michael Franke's background, but what we didn't say is that Michael was a hardworking, dedicated, and determined individual. And he was expected the same out of those who worked for him. Michael was known to work late many, if not most, work days. He often worked into the evening. On Tuesday, January 17th, 1989, Michael Franke held a regular meeting. This was with the five division heads and other top staff members on his staff. On this Tuesday, the meeting lasted until 6 p.m. Michael Franke talked with some personnel after and was seen by several people inside what is the Dome Building, what is called the Dome Building. There were several floors of offices in this building, and Michael Franke's office is on the ground level. Reports from witnesses indicate that Mr. Franke left the Dome Building shortly after 6:30 p.m. Other reports indicate that it was closer to 6:45 p.m., but just to be clear, no reports read that Mr. Franke left his office after 6:45 p.m. Two senior staff leaving the Dome Building approximately 40 minutes later discovered Michael Franke's car parked in its designated spot outside the front entryway with the driver's door open. Franke's white Pontiac Bonneville was one of only a few cars left in the parking lot at the corrections headquarters at this time of night. The two staffers observed no noticeable damage to the vehicle, and no obvious signs of forced entry on the vehicle were observed. The staffers closed and locked the car door and returned to the Dome Building. where they made numerous phone calls to other senior staffers to determine Frankie's whereabouts, all to no avail. Security was notified at the nearby communication center, and the staffers left the dome building at approximately 8.05 p.m. Two other senior staffers, Richard Peterson, head of institutions, and David Coley, head of planning and budget, arrived at approximately 8.35 p.m. and conducted what they described as a meticulous search of the dome building, but found nothing amiss. There was thought that maybe someone had picked Michael Frankie up, and maybe they had went to dinner. This was discussed by several of the persons looking for him. So the senior staff members went home for the night after they failed to locate Mr. Frankie and assumed that he was at a private dinner engagement. Police were not notified at this time. Around 12:30 a.m., January 18th, the night watchman on duty, Stephen Rubino, was told to be especially observant as he made his rounds of the dome building. Now, as he came to a dimly lit porch at the side of the building, Rubino spotted a large man sprawled on the porch. He was surrounded by bloodstains, and a panel of glass at the porch doorway was smashed. The night watchman had discovered Michael Frankie's body. Police secured the area. The inspectors quickly noticed some of Michael Frankie's belongings may be missing. This was his briefcase. There was also broken glass on and near his body. Now, it's believed that Michael Frankie, as he was being murdered, he had tried to unlock the door to get back into the DOC office, the Department of Corrections office, but could not unlock the doors. And in his final moments of life, Frankie broke a glass panel from the door, attempting to get inside or, at the very least, call for help. Some have said that all of Frankie's documents from his year-long investigation were later shredded at the Department of Corrections within hours of his body being found. This is according to, quote, inside sources. Now, these inside sources are not listed, just to be clear here. The newspapers that very same day covered the story. The information that they released was this: Michael Frankie was found stabbed to death just outside the office building in which he worked. He died of a stab wound to the heart with massive bleeding. The medical examiner said it was, quote, a definite homicide, but there were no suspects.
So now we have a judge that was brought in to clean up this prison system, and he is murdered.
Yeah, and later the Michael Frankie murder investigation was described as the largest of its kind in Oregon history at that time. The number of investigators fluctuated between 6 and 30 full-time investigators. Mm. The media coverage was intense, to say the least, and then Governor Neil Goldschmidt, he was really, according to the papers, putting the police department under intense pressure to make an arrest and bring closure to the case. Of course, given the nature of Frankie's work, the possibility that the murder was a hit was immediately considered.
Right.
Despite interviews with thousands of people, including several convicts, and a reward fund exceeding $20,000, the investigators assigned to the case were not catching any big breaks early on in the investigation. What we do know was this. Due to eyewitness accounts, the police were convinced that the killer was a dark-haired man with a light-colored coat who was seen running from the scene, but that man's identity was unknown. There were some problems with the investigation. One being that the time of death was not known. So the window for the time of death is simply 6:30 p.m., which is approximately the last time that Mr. Frankie was seen,
right?
And just after 12:30 a.m. when his body was found.
He's found by security, right?
Correct.
So do they not have any security cameras in this facility?
They did not. And the thing here is, Captain, we can't even, at the very least, narrow that down any, because when his body was found, the body temperature was never taken nor recorded,
right,
which would have shortened that window for us. So all we can say is that sometime between the last time he was seen alive and the time that he was found dead near this door, that's when he was killed.
Another question. Keypad entries, or is it strictly just...
It's a key. It's 1989, mm-hmm. and this... So we need to be clear here. This is a little bit difficult. You say, well, if there were several people looking for this individual, why was he not located? Mm-hmm. Well, there's a couple problems with this. Okay, so it's January 1 is a problem, because by the time he would have left work that day, it was already dark. So they're at a disadvantage, right, looking for someone, especially outside, where he would later be found. And this, the door that he died in front of was, it was like a side door, and I believe it was on the second floor. So let's say he was attacked. His car door was found open. So there's some thought that he was attacked at that car,
right,
and then managed to try to seek help, and he made it to that door before he expired. So,
but you say the door that he was found on was the second floor.
Yes. So I don't know if this would have been the nearest door for him. I'm guessing that's where he would go to.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say it's the nearest door. He would have had to run from his vehicle after being attacked and then go up the stairs and try to get into that door. And then, unfortunately, he passed away there before help could arrive. Or the attack continued. That the attacker followed him up there and killed him in front of the door.
So no keypads and no security video footage of this.
Correct. And you bringing up the keypad is interesting, because there was at least, off the top of my head, Captain, I think only one article that I found regarding the case and the crime scene. There was an article that stated...
That's not many articles on the case.
No, I meant stating the following. That the locks to the doors were changed that day. Now, I don't know that I believe that. I have no reason to discredit it. I have no proof that it didn't happen that day. But what I will say is this. This will be obvious by the end of this episode. There's a lot of questions around this murder. And there's a lot of thoughts about who committed this crime. And I think that the idea of the locks being changed that day adds to the mystique of it, or to the confusion,
right,
of the whole crime scene. The problem I have with that statement, though, Captain, is that Michael Franke was the boss. He was the number one dude in this building. There were, as I said, there were several floors of offices inside this building of the Oregon Department of Corrections building.
Right.
He was the man in there. If the door locks were changed that day, if there's one person that you make sure has that key when the doors are changed, when the locks are changed,
it's the boss.
It's that guy. It's that guy. Yeah. And the other thing, too, to paint the picture of the scene, or to get an idea of what, when we try to think of what could have happened to this man,
Bob Ross,
please keep in mind, Michael Franke, remember we said he went to college on a football scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
This was not a tiny man. This dude was 6'3", 225 pounds.
And he wasn't the kicker.
I have no idea what position he played.
I'm just saying he could have went to played football and he could have been the kicker.
Well, he could have been, but...
Changes things a little bit.
But what we know, he was not small. He was 6'3", 225 to 230 pounds.
Yeah, this is a big guy. We'll get right back to this after this quick beer break.
The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Everyone is still talking about Monopoly Go, for a good reason. It is an absolute hit. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table. Like countless crazy tournaments you can join with your friends as partners or teams. Or timed events, offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums. Delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches. unique playing pieces, and so much more. The verdict is in. With Monopoly Go, there's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now free on the App Store and Google Play.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down.
If you're thinking of starting therapy, I highly recommend that you give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/garage today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/garage. This show is proudly sponsored by BetterHelp. Check out BetterHelp.com/garage today.
The best part of spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity you get. It's kind of like when you find out that you've been paying a fortune for wireless. When Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. It's time to switch to Mint Mobile. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited time deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. Save a lot of money with Mint Mobile. Get their great mobile wireless service delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. That's premium service at a great price. To get this new customer offer and your new three-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/TCG. That's mintmobile.com/TCG. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/TCG. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Everyone loves a good family mystery, especially one with as many twists and turns as June's Journey, a hidden object mystery game with a captivating detective story. It takes you back to the glamour of the 1920s with a diverse cast of characters. You'll step into the role of June Parker and search for hidden clues to uncover the mystery of her sister's murder. Use your observation skills to quickly uncover key pieces of information that lead to chapters of mystery, danger, and romance. And customize your very own luxurious estate island. Think expansive gardens and beautiful buildings. Collect scraps of information to fill your photo album and learn more about each character. And you can chat and play with or against other players by joining a detective club. Can you crack the case? Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android.
All right, cheers, me mateys.
Arr. Arr. Cheers, Captain.
Arr.
We have a big break in the case. Because on April 8th, 1990, this is nearly 15 months after Frankie's death, the police arrested Frank Gable, who was at the time 30 years old. He's arrested for the murder of Michael Frankie.
So who is he?
Frank Gable, his name did not surface as a suspect, I guess, until about 8 months after the crime, when the murder investigation was at what they were calling at the time a standstill. Two people initially pointed the finger at Gable. One was Michael Kearns. The other tipster was Janine Vera Gable, Frank Gable's wife. So the police at this time believe that Michael Franke was murdered in an attempted robbery. The police interrogated known drug dealers and street criminals looking to figure out if somebody had heard something. You know, they want to find out the word on the streets, right? One of them claimed that he witnessed the murder and then identified the killer as a drug dealer named Frank Gable. According to this witness, Gable was in the act of breaking into Michael Franke's car, when Michael came out of the office building around 7 p.m. Gable then stabbed Franke, very badly wounding him. It is believed at this time that Gable stole Michael Franke's briefcase and fled the scene. Michael Franke then staggered up a set of stairs to a side entrance to the building, attempting to get in. Could not, and then broke the glass pane on the door in a desperate attempt to get back into his office. Now, after getting this tip that led police to drug dealer Frank Gable, Frank was already in jail for beating his wife when he was arraigned for killing Oregon prison director Michael Franke. The charges, go ahead.
So Frankie's attacked January of 89. When is the suspect arrested for beating his wife?
That I don't know. And I'm going to be honest with you, Captain. I don't know a ton about this Frank Gable. It wasn't until April of 1990 that he is charged with Frankie's murder. But we do know that he got onto police radar about 8 months after the murder. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that means he was locked up around that same time. One of my thoughts is that it could very well be the case, because one of the witnesses is his wife, right, who he has already been charged with assaulting, and he's in jail for that assault.
Right.
So one good thing is, hey, we got a suspect that we really like, and he's not going to be hard to find because we know where he is. He's sitting in a jail somewhere. But with his wife being one of the supposed eyewitnesses or people willing to point the finger at this Frank Gable, I can't believe that if that was going on in their relationship, that she was going to tell the police about it before he's arrested for hitting her. Now, the charges for Frank Gable would be 6 counts of aggravated murder and 1 count of intentional murder for allegedly fatally stabbing Michael Franke. Aggravated murder is a capital crime in Oregon, and the prosecutors said they will seek the death penalty if Gable is convicted. Now, investigators never found a weapon or other physical evidence tying Gable to the crime. And Gable, well, he never confessed to the crime either. In fact, in a jailhouse interview after his court appearance, Gable said he was innocent, saying, quote, "Don't let me get railroaded." He told KOIN television, "I just ask that they not stop looking. There's a killer out there somewhere." The indictment offers a series of possible motives for the murder, including that Gable killed Franke during a theft or robbery, or that the slaying was related to Frankie's work as a prison's chief. At trial, the prosecutor said that Franke caught Gable breaking into his car, and in a panic, Gable stabbed him. Now, again, no physical evidence was produced, even at trial. However, the prosecution was allowed to introduce as evidence a knife that was purchased by investigators, which matched Frankie's wounds. Gable's ex-wife testified that she had gave Gable a similar knife at some point in their relationship.
All right. That seems like there's some holes, no pun intended, in this.
Is that the worst evidence you've ever heard?
Yeah. I mean, again, have some proof, have some evidence. I mean, if she had a receipt of a knife that she bought prior, then okay. But
right.
But we don't. So, and how many stab wounds do we have?
His autopsy is difficult. So The way that it reads is that he was stabbed directly in the heart. The problem with what was released to the public is that we don't know if that stab came from the back or the front.
Right.
There was not a ton of information released publicly regarding his autopsy. They do state that there were some defensive wounds on the victim There was also some sign of blunt force trauma. However, this sounds terrible. The blunt force trauma, they don't believe was part of the attack. They actually believe that his body, that blunt force trauma to the body occurred when he was most likely slumped up against the door and the wall in the corner as he was trying to get into that door, that office door, to get help.
Right.
And then at some point he fell onto the concrete. And they believe that that blunt force trauma to the body occurred at that time and not during the course of the attack.
So I'm going to ask an obvious question. I'm hoping for an obvious answer.
Okay. You're putting me on the spot, Kevin.
So he's breaking into a car. He's breaking into the vehicle. That's what they think happened. That's what the prosecution is stating. So we have fingerprints.
No, we don't. Mm. And again, remember, the troubling thing here, too, is we have the eyewitnesses, the people that closed the car door, that found the car door open, Frankie's car door open, they stated that they didn't see any damage to the car, any sign of a scuffle, any obvious signs that somebody broke into the vehicle.
Right.
You know, it almost looks like, to me, with given that description, it more likely sounds to me that Frankie opened up his own car door and then was attacked. And the car door just happened to be left open.
Possibly, or
the way that the prosecution paints the picture is that Frank Gable's in mid break-in, and I would have to guess Frank Gable's already got the door open by the time that Frankie discovers him and says, "Hey, buddy, what are you doing with my car?"
Yeah, what are you doing?
Now you got a 6'3" large man getting ready to come down upon you for breaking into his car.
Yeah, breathe heavy into your ear.
Well, and I think we don't. Let's go ahead.
But Frank Gable could have just been checking cars to see if they're unlocked. And then he goes, "Oh, this car's unlocked." I open up the door. Right when I open up the door, Frankie sees me.
Yeah.
So that could have happened too. That's a possibility. But again, guess whose hand's on that door? Mm-hmm. Unless you're telling me that he was wearing gloves or whatever.
The individual that was spotted is believed to have been wearing gloves. That there was a man. Remember, we have the eyewitness account of a dark-haired man in a light-colored coat running from the scene. The problem with that is this person is spotted running from the area of the vehicle, not necessarily running from a murder scene. You know, it's not like anybody says, "I saw a murder or a man attacked, and then this description of this guy ran away from the area."
Right.
No, there's just a dude that's spotted in the area. Now, that guy, from every statement I could find, sounds like the guy was wearing gloves. So,
well, and it could just be a guy that, you know, randomly was leaving work and decided, you know what, I really need to get in better shape. I'm going to start right now. Running.
Well, and look, it's January. Don't people wear gloves in January? Mm-hmm. I mean, I do. Get with it, people. Put on some gloves.
Hey, don't you wear gloves?
I also wear socks in January too.
Yeah.
Hey, at the trial, the state produced several witnesses. This is going to be the troubling thing for Mr. Frank Gable. These witnesses, all of whom were criminal associates of Gable, and claim that Gable confessed the crime to them after the fact. The testimonies were from the following. First, we have a woman named Jody Swearingen. She's a local teen runaway who testified before a grand jury that she had witnessed the murder. Police reports indicate that she had identified Frank Gable as the perpetrator of that murder. Then we have Cappy, a.k.a. Shorty Harden.
Cappy Shorty.
If your first name is Cappy, do you need a nickname? Unless you're incredibly short, then he's Shorty. Yeah. What if he's like 3'7"? Then you're Shorty.
Yeah.
He testified at trial that he was parked near the dome building with the young woman we just discussed, Jody Swearingen. When
Shorty was?
Yeah. He saw Frank Gable, according to Cappy, or Shorty, whatever you want to call him, he saw Frank Gable stab Michael Frankie.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have Mike Kearns. We also have Dan Walsh and Kevin Walker. All three separately testified that Gable confessed to them that he had killed Frankie. So
why are these guys in the area? Why is this guy parked
I don't know if they were parked in the car and fooling around or if they were leaving the area. So this building is actually near a very large hospital. So almost across the street from the parking lot where we believe Michael Franke was attacked would be a very large parking lot for a state hospital. So they very likely could have been in the state hospital parking lot.
Right, but I want to know why they were there. It seems to me that they're just finding people that know Frank Gable and just going, hey, just say you're there.
Oh, no, I apologize. I think the way that I described that is weird. I don't believe that Jody Swearingen and this Shorty Harden actually knew who Frank Gable was.
Okay.
They were able to say, hey, the person we saw attack Michael Franke was this man. They were able to identify him. The people that knew Frank Gable were that Michael Cairns, Dan Walsh, Kevin Walker. These were known associates of Gable's who at one point he confessed, according to them, that he had killed Michael Franke. Then we have Janine Vera. Remember, the married to Gable at the time of Frankie's murder.
Right.
She testified that Gable was not home on the night of the murder and that she didn't know where he was. She also testified that Gable said at some point, quote, I stuck the guy. She says, what guy? He says, quote, the guy at the hospital, Gable answered. Now, that's an interesting statement here, Captain, because one thing I had wondered about when the prosecution gave their theory of the events and of the murder and how it occurred and the motive,
right,
was that this guy's breaking into a car. Well, if I'm a criminal, if I'm a thief,
you probably are.
I'm not choosing a vehicle that's in the parking lot of the Department of Corrections, the headquarters for the Department of Corrections.
Unless you don't know. Unless you think it's a hospital.
Right. And that's what's interesting about what she says when she testifies, that Gable referred to him as the guy at the hospital. The other thing that's interesting there, too, is that that also implies that Frank Gable did not know the man that he attacked. He didn't know him by name.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the verdict, that little bit of evidence, those people testifying, that's all the evidence they had. All hearsay. All circumstantial.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we had last week's case of Scott Peterson where people got a little upset and said, how can you convict on circumstantial evidence? There was what I would refer to as a mountain of circumstantial evidence against Scott Peterson. Against Frank Gable here, however, that's it. That's a molehill of circumstantial evidence.
Well, I still like the way that Nancy Grace talks about it. Is the idea that you go into work and it's sunny and it's beautiful out. Then you go out for lunch and there's puddles everywhere and your car is wet. And there's all this circumstantial evidence that lets you know that it probably rained.
Right.
And so that's how you get to that conclusion. Yeah, there's not a mountain of evidence here. The difficult things, one is your two eyewitnesses are criminals. Than these so-called associates that you confess to?
Well, it's believed, and I'm going to say allegedly, because I can't say that I have hardcore evidence of this or saw lots of reports stating the same, but allegedly, I would guess 5 out of the 6 people that testified that he was guilty, or 6 out of 6 would have been probably drug users at the time. And I can say that because look, Frank Gable was a known drug dealer. Right. And so his associates are either going to be other dealers or users, most likely. Okay. And they've also been referred to publicly in newspaper articles as just that, as drug users. As far as Jody Swearingen and Cappy Harden go, AKA Shorty, I believe similar that they were drug users at the time. Again, I don't think they had any knowledge of Frank Gable prior to seeing the person that they described as Frank Gable stabbing Michael Franke.
So what's interesting is with Frank Gable is you wonder, why would he break into somebody's car? I mean, if he's a drug dealer, then why are you breaking into somebody's car? That's kind of a lower level crime. So you're probably making money off the drugs. Why would you break into a car? But if the car is, you think, is at a hospital, or you breaking into it because you think this person is a doctor and there's something that you can get out of this. You could get some prescription pills or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting thing that you bring up here. And one thought is that, okay, so Frank Gable was considered, quote unquote, a career criminal by this point in his life. This is somebody that has had trouble with the law. It wasn't his first run-in with the law. He was a known drug dealer. He was a guy that was going to make his living off of committing crimes.
Can you imagine that, though? I mean, you and I have both been in positions where we're at a job that we're not in love with.
Mm-hmm.
But it pays okay, and the benefits are all right. So it starts becoming, hey, maybe I can turn this into a career. Can you imagine the guy that's selling a little bit of dope here, a little bit of dope there, breaking into cars, starts thinking, I don't have many options. This is going to be my career.
Well, the other thing, though, too, is I don't know that it's about options. I think a lot of times with these individuals, it's about they don't give a shit about 2 weeks from now, 2 months from now, 2 years from now.
That's right.
They're living in the moment, and it's how can I get some money for today, maybe tonight, maybe tomorrow is the furthest they can think ahead. So let's talk about the car, though, Captain. So neither Frankie's car phone nor his stereo were tampered with. We do know that from the police reports.
Yeah, the car phone.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, remember back then, I'm guessing it's one of those Motorola deals that has like it has a little station with it. It looks almost like a tiny briefcase.
Yeah.
And some people would keep it in their glove box or kind of there in the center between the two front seats. So it'd be very obvious. Now, what makes that interesting, though, too, is if I am a criminal looking for something expensive and I see that sitting on the passenger seat or in the front portion of the vehicle, I'm going to go, man, I'd like to steal that car phone, right? So,
The question here is now, is this car owned by Frankie or is this given to him by the state?
I believe that he owns the vehicle. Mm-hmm. And the only thing I have to go off of is that it's referred to as Frankie's car phone and his stereo were not tampered with.
Well, because sometimes, I mean, heads of detectives will get a detective vehicle, for example, and they might have their radio in there, but also have emergency cell phone mm-hmm. service. So that's kind of why I was wondering. And then that also makes me wonder, if it was owned by the state, then how many people have access to keys?
The other thing that we should call into question is the body. So Michael Frankie's watch, wallet and cash were still on him when he was found after he was dead.
What kind of watch was it?
How would I know what kind of I don't know what kind of watch it is.
I think if you're trying to if you're the defense, for example, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you say, hey, he's wearing a baller watch, he's wearing a Timex, he's wearing a Rolex.
Is Timex a baller?
No,
Timex
no,
is not a baller watch.
That's what makes it a joke.
Those are the people that are balling in fifth grade.
Right, but what I'm saying is that does make a difference, and you'd think that the defense would have brought this up to say, hey, if he was breaking into the car because he wanted to get money or whatever he was looking for, then wouldn't he take this watch? I mean, if it's a crap watch, you're not going to take it. I mean, it might have been a little calculator watch. We don't know because it's not reported.
But again, these items would suggest that the money was not the priority of the killer, is what a lot of people would point out.
Again, my problem with Frank Gable's motive is if he is a drug dealer, one, why would you be breaking into cars? That seems like a downward move in your career. You're selling drugs. You're making money. You're balling out of control. You're wearing Timex. You got 5 Timex on your left arm. So why are you breaking into the car? But again, he thought it was the hospital. So you're breaking into a car because you think it's a doctor's car. So you're trying to break in to get drugs or a prescription pad or whatever it is.
Possibly. I don't know that I would say that Frank Gable was above breaking into cars. Again, I believe this is an individual that's a career criminal. Those types of individuals look for opportunity, and when opportunity presents itself, they seize the moment and steal whatever it is that they can. Captain, they did not need Nancy Grace sitting on the sidelines cheerleading for the prosecution here, because the verdict that would come down, Gable was found guilty and received life in prison with no chance of parole. All right. So an open and shut case, right?
Yep.
Easy. Easy. I'll see you next week.
Done. One parter. Great one parter.
Right. Well, not so fast as there are major doubts in this case. There were TV and newspapers that came forward in February of 1991. And this started prior to Gable's conviction. The Michael Franke story was featured on an episode of the TV program Unsolved Mysteries.
Mm.
The killing sparked widespread speculation that Franke was murdered because he was about to expose corruption in his department. One of Frankie's brothers.
Well, that's what he was also hired for, though.
Yes, it's believed that he was hired for, that was part of the reason that he was hired. Mm-hmm. One of Frankie's brothers said that the prison's chief told him shortly before his death that he had discovered organized crime elements in the prison's system. The case also became somewhat of a battleground between the three leading Portland newspapers. A leading advocate for the wrongful conviction slash conspiracy theory was local journalist Phil Stanford. Stanford wrote extensively on the case and wrote a screenplay for a film based on the Franke murder called Without Evidence. This was released in 1995, featuring Angelina Jolie in one of her first major roles. Now, she played the person that we already mentioned, Jody Swearengen. Then, even after the conviction, persons close to the case started calling into question many interesting aspects of the case and the murder scene. We already discussed the car. We already discussed the body. But one thing that they would keep going back to is the timing of the murder, because we have Frankie's brother who says that shortly before his murder, he told him he was going after an organized criminal element within the prison system. Frankie's employees told police he had received threats shortly before he was murdered and on several occasions sent security guards to his home. Now we have Chuck Sides, a former state lawmaker who played basketball with Michael Franke, that later said that shortly before Frankie's murder, that Franke started carrying a pistol in his gym bag for self-defense because he was taking steps to disrupt drug trafficking inside the prisons.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite interesting, Captain, for several reasons. Because we have the prosecution that state that the main motive for the murder of Michael Franke was that he disrupted a car thief.
Right.
And it was killed as a reactionary thing during the course of that robbery. Right. Mm-hmm. And here we have a lawmaker. We have people that he worked with that are saying that there obviously was something in Michael Franke's life that he believed that he was in danger. He's sending police officers to his home from time to time. He's actively carrying a gun in his gym bag.
Right.
These would point to signs that this man believed that he was going to be part of a premeditated attack on his life and not necessarily a situation where he surprises a car thief.
Yeah, so then the question becomes, did he just interrupt a simple car break-in, or was his investigation such on the right track that it was leading him down the wrong path with the wrong people? Make sure you follow us on all social media platforms at True Crime Garage. Make sure you share and tell a friend, you crazy bastards.
And drop everything you're doing. Go to iTunes and tell them how much you love us. Big 5 stars. 5 out of 5 stars. Until tomorrow, everybody, be good, be kind, and don't litter.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.